Okay, I said this at the beginning of the last hour. I'm going to say it here again. 25 minutes left in open lines, issues, etc. We're listening to Dateline NBC. Their investigative report of Benny Hinn. What's your reaction? Did you see it? If you didn't see it, we've given you an opportunity to listen to the entire segment here, and we will finish it up in just a moment. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'd like your reaction, your comments on Dateline NBC and the treatment of Benny Hinn. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In 25 minutes, Frank Sherwin will join us. There's a discovery you may have read about in Sunday's paper. Bones may be those of first walking ancestor hominid found in Ethiopia nearly 4 million years old. We'll find out what the claims of this archaeological find are, and we'll evaluate them with Frank Sherwin of the Institute for Creation Research in the last 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Until then, we pick up with an interview between Dateline NBC's Bob McCowan and Benny Hinn after a crusade in Toronto. This interview was recorded on a hidden camera.
Why will you not audit and publicly release your finances, and why will you not, if you indeed you do, as you say, verify miracles, why will you not release that medical information?
Well, I'll sit with you and talk to you about it.
Well, we've talked about this before, and you have not gladly sat.
I asked Pastor Hinn about William.
Do you remember the little boy named William in Las Vegas? Was that a verifiable miracle?
We do it with a pure heart, I can assure you.
Then Pastor Benny explained that he relies on his staffers to tell him about the people that appear on his stage.
This Portuguese, when he comes up on a platform, I'm only able to know what happens because they tell me so.
But isn't that the point, that they don't know, and neither do you?
They're checked as much as possible in the line.
Let's talk on camera.
He wasn't happy when I told him we were already recording our conversation.
We've been on camera.
No, no.
I should know that.
But the thing is, I think it's more proper if I can sit with you in a studio, have the questions, answer them honestly, and then let's... But I think to come, you know, at midnight or whatever time it is when I really is thinking...
Sir, I've been asking you for an interview for 3 years.
Well, I did not...
And I'm still waiting.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll call you.
Pastor Benny didn't call. As for TV producer Nathan Daniel, who says he asked too many questions, the ministry told us he's a disgruntled employee and was fired for cause. And what about this Hinn security man? He still does work for the ministry and says he remains disenchanted.
And when you see the people that I've seen giving their last dollars so that their sick child or that their sick father or mother or daughter can get healed by Benny, that's absolutely wrong.
Forensic accountant Keith Balla thinks Hinn's followers should speak out.
People should be up in arms and ask for an accounting, an audit. An audit, internal controls.
But what about the Internal Revenue Service? Doesn't the government demand an accounting? The IRS does not require a church to make its finances public or to pay any taxes.
All right, just a pause, and the report is almost over. But that's quite true. Under IRS regulations, you don't have to have full disclosure. But who cares about IRS regulations? Since when are Christians concerned about being accountable only when we're absolutely required to be accountable by government regulatory agencies like the IRS? Whatever happened to good old-fashioned honesty, good old-fashioned let's be above board? Let's lay all our cards on the table because we have nothing to hide. Now, I'm intrigued by one of Mr. Hinn's claims there in that secret hidden camera interview. I'm intrigued by it. He says, look, I rely on staffers to tell me about these people who come up on the stage with me, and I only go based upon the stories they've told. Sounds like Benny's not even concerned with whether the stories are particularly true or not. He simply assumes they're true. And do you honestly think, those of you who are Benny Hinn fans, honestly think, and maybe you've been to a crusade, that when Benny interviews someone there on the stage, and he's operating only with what his handlers have told him, and golly, my staffers told me that they're healed, and they think they're healed, and they believe they're healed. Do you honestly think, as someone sitting there in the crusade listening, that when Benny then turns to the rest of the audience and says, this young man has been healed, that those listening don't honestly believe that they've been healed? Now, Benny says, oh, I don't know they've been healed. I'm just going on what they say. I have no evidence of it. My staff tells me the story, and we go from there. Then why doesn't he say that in the crusade? My staffers tell me this young man believes he was healed. Now, that would be the truth. My staffers tell me that this young man believes he is healed. Do you believe you've been healed? Yes, I do. That's all the more you could say. That would be an, if you ask me, I got a real problem with someone going around saying they can affect miraculous healings as long as they can prove it. And for some reason, the whole burden of proof completely disappears if it's someone like Benny Hinn. They don't have to prove it. They're anointed of God. Since when do the anointed of God not have to prove anything? Is this how Jesus conducted his healing ministry? Oh, guys, you should have seen me. I was just behind that rock there over by the seashore. Whole crowd of blind people healed them. They're all walkaways. Where are they? Well, those guys off in the distance there. See them? They used to be blind. Healed them. Really? Wow. Now give me your money. No. Oh, look, see those guys walking down the street? You just missed it. You just missed it. Lepers. Every one of them, I healed them all. No. Jesus heals 10 lepers. Does he ask them for a penny? No. He says, go show yourself to the priests. The priests were, by the way, the ones who would verify whether or not someone had leprosy or not. Go show yourself to the priests. Go. First order of business, let's make sure that everyone knows that this really happened. Jesus doesn't stand in a crowd and say, this woman says she's been healed, or my disciples tell me that she says she's been healed, therefore she's been healed. No. First of all, Jesus really heals them. And when Jesus heals someone, there's no question as to whether or not they've been healed. The woman who is healed of a 25-year issue of blood does not walk away and 3 weeks later die of the same issue of blood. No. Ben is calling from his car. Ben, welcome to Issues, etc.
Hi, hey, I'm a pretty new listener to your show, and I really enjoy it, and I just want to thank you for your ministry. And one of the things about last night's Dateline is I wish they would have built on, I guess it was Michael Horton, I believe his name was, who alluded to just for a couple of seconds, and that was the whole prosperity theology and why it is that the contributors to his ministry and probably the people in the ministry and Benny Hinn himself think it's okay to live lavishly and to just throw that money around and you know, multi-million-dollar homes and on and on and on. I wish they would have built on that more rather than just kind of showing the same clips over and over, you know.
Well, that's television, though, Ben. But by the way, we're going to play the rest of the report, and Horton does get a chance to at least briefly comment on that. And we talked with Shane Rosenthal earlier today on a different subject. Shane is Horton's producer on the White Horse Inn, and he said, look, a lot of stuff ends up on the cutting room floor. And I know that Horton's deepest concern he shares with me, and that is the falseness of the prosperity gospel, as you have so rightly pointed out. Next time we have a mic on, we'll ask him about it. He's been doing a lot of press lately, and we'll ask him about this one in particular, too. Paul is calling from his car. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Wanted to mention, you know, touching on all these subjects of the validity of the miracles or the, you know, the fiscal responsibility of him and his ministry. I, you know, just days ago, I had happened to listen to a 22-minute CD of some of Hinn's prophecies that are very, you know, well-known among many that keep in touch with this type of theology that he'd given in December of 89 and had made several clearly false prophecies, such as, you know, the destruction of the homosexual community in the mid-90s and the death of Castro in the 90s, for example. And I just... You know, I'm surprised even that at times that something like Dateline wouldn't use something like that, because, you know, the importance for us as Christians is to see that is that the language that Hinn uses is that it couldn't be clearer when he says that thus saith the Lord or the Lord tells me to tell you. He clearly is claiming a direct divine revelation from God, and his followers may be quick to say, as they said in some of those responses, that you shouldn't touch the Lord's anointed. But, you know, it's interesting that nobody's asking that Hinn be subject to any other critique than what the Old Testament prophets would have been subject to under the same circumstances. And if I could just make one last point on what you said about that couple whose little boy was sick and they had followed him around the country and had said, you know, that their lack of faith perhaps is why he died. I would just want to say that if they're following him around the country to the point of putting their lives on hold and doing that for a great time, in the pursuit of his healing, if that doesn't demonstrate their faith, what would?
You're right. I agree. If it is, golly. And they also gave a big chunk of their money to Benny Hinn, too, hoping for their son's healing. Were they deceived? Yes, they were they were sincere in their deception. They had been deceived. Paul, thank you very much. And I'm glad you raised the whole issue of the prophecies of Benny Hinn as well, something not touched upon so much in the way that the secular media is going to go at it. Why? Because that's a harder sell to make. That's a harder sell to make when you've got the more obvious ratings getters of the man rakes in the cash and the man makes promises of healing. You go with that. Now, who knows? The McCowan report may in fact have included something like this, but as Rosenthal pointed out a few minutes ago, a lot of stuff ends up on the cutting room floor. They may have talked about his prophecies. You know, one sure way to make sure that a prophet is true or false, the Bible says, is whether or not the prophecy comes true. There's no rocket science involved here. There's no advanced calculus. There is no quantum physics. It's all very simple. If a prophet says, "Thus saith the Lord," and makes a prediction, and that prediction doesn't come true, God says, "He doesn't speak for me." You will know if the prophecy comes true. Now, if Benny Hinn says that Fidel Castro will die sometime in the 1990s, and we're already at 2005, God apparently keeps the same calendar we do, or maybe he changes it when he talks to Benny. Who knows? We're already here at 2005. Castro, while older and grayer, is, the last time I checked, still very much alive. And Benny said, "Thus saith the Lord. The Lord told me. The Lord has spoken to me." However he wants to put it, the Castro will die. We're dealing with a false prophet. The funny thing is, and this goes back to what Reggie said earlier about the spin that gets put on things like this, the followers of Hinn will say, "No, no, you don't understand how prophecy works. It's not a 100% thing. These guys are caught up in the spirit. Sometimes they're not hearing the spirit right. I mean, the spirit might be communicating in things too deep for even them to understand. And Benny might have misinterpreted what the spirit was saying, or maybe he was getting a little ahead of himself. You know, and after all, it's Benny. Come on. He's a little bit of the court jester of the whole TBN world. So come on. You got to cut him a break." The Bible speaks in no such terms about those who claim to speak for the Lord. And I can guarantee you, if I were to end today's broadcast by saying, "Thus saith the Lord," and making a prediction, the same people who defend Benny Hinn's false prophecies would come down my throat saying, "You're a false prophet, and we have proof. You made a prediction and it didn't come true." And if you can take one thing away from our whole dealing with this subject today, we've dealt with it many times, you can take one thing away, it is that the saddest thing about the false teachings and practices of Benny Hinn is that it robs his followers and his devotees of the ability to see the truth. False teaching robs its advocates of the ability to discern truth from falsehood in every area. So where the Bible says clearly that a false prophet is one who says, "Thus saith the Lord," and speaks a lie, and it's proven to be a lie because the thing doesn't happen. And by the way, you might check this out in Deuteronomy 13. The penalty for such a prophet is not, "Oh, come on, cut him a break. It's just Benny Hinn." Or, "Prophecy isn't a 100% thing." Or, "The spirit moves in mysterious ways." No, the penalty is death. God says, the one thing you cannot do is claim to speak for me and speak lies. God takes false prophecy, whether it's in predictions or in preaching, very, very seriously. And it's not just Benny Hinn, folks. Hopefully we'll have time here at the end of this 25 minutes for me to make that point. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Pastor Todd, it just is more of a general comment, but it just seems that Christian TV gets way off base, where Christian radio stays pretty close. I mean, there are things that are objectionable on Christian radio, but Christian radio is a quantum leap better than Christian TV. And I've always thought that, you know, that God warned us about the visual, And, you know, perhaps the spoken word is you have to think a little bit more. You're not distracted by images. I just have a hard time. I mean, there's Dr. Kennedy on Sunday morning, but for the most part, which I've not seen on Sunday morning, but I expect it's not it's not the Crystal Cathedral and this sort of thing. But I just have to think that, I don't know, I'd like your comment on that.
Well, I'm glad you made that observation, because it kind of leads directly into what I had just said I was going to say. Which is more dangerous, Benny Hinn, who through flash and dash and the magic of the media and a very slick and elegant personal visual appearance on television deceives the many? Or one who just sits behind a microphone, you don't know what they look like, you don't really care what they look like, but they're held more accountable because you got to go by what they say. The visual isn't there, so you got to go by what they say. I mean, that's why radio perhaps has less word faith teaching. However, here's the real danger. And it has nothing to do with whether or not the guy looks good or even sounds good. It has to do with what they preach. There still is not enough Jesus Christ and Him crucified on Christian radio. Christian radio, and I'm not speaking so much about the Christian radio of which I am a part, but in general, as an enterprise, how would you divide it up? In the course of a programming day, one quarter infomercial, it could be for anything. For vitamins? For the latest kind of wacky alternative medicine? One quarter of it is perhaps kind of dollar a holler. That is, any preacher who's got enough money to get on the air can say anything he wants to say. And there doesn't seem to be any filter at all for whether it's true or false. It's just a matter of, hey, are you paying for airtime? A quarter of it might be the big evangelist, like Joyce Meyer. Now, she's soft sell word faith, so it's still there. And another quarter of it might be good, solid Bible teaching, principles for living. Chuck Swindoll was mentioned before. But in all of it, wherever it is, how much is Christ the center of what is being proclaimed? Even if you discount all the kooky stuff in the infomercials that really have nothing to do with Christianity at all, how much of it is about the Christian rather than the Christ? How much of it is about Jesus, the teacher, the healer, the coach, the therapist, the friend, the lover, the whatever, and very little about Jesus, the sinless Savior of mankind? The cross, while it would certainly get honorable mention, it wouldn't necessarily be denied by a lot of Christian radio, doesn't stand at the center of a lot of what's said there. That's the real danger of Benny Hinn, is that the cross gets lost in the shuffle. He does deceive many through his erroneous teachings, but what he doesn't say is more dangerous. Believe it or not, what he doesn't say is more dangerous than what he does say. He says the Trinity has 9 persons in it. Now, he's subsequently denied that he has really said it, but he said it twice. I mean, people who deny that they've said something generally don't repeat it, but he says the Trinity has 9 persons. Why is that dangerous? It's dangerous insofar as it impacts what people believe about Jesus at the cross. And I'll be quite honest with you, folks. Jesus the healer is not the gospel. Jesus the Savior, on the other hand, is. And that's what you don't hear. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I was going to say here, there's something more dangerous than Benny Hinn. Benny Hinn is easy to avoid. I mean, he's got the look of an evangelist. He's got the sound of an evangelist. He's got the feel of an evangelist. Most people will have a natural revulsion to that kind of slick, manipulated forum that Benny Hinn presents on television. Most people will. Some people get sucked in by it. Some of them are sucked in simply because they're just honestly desperate. And it's hard to blame those people. But far more dangerous, yet more subtle, is the preacher who wastes his people's time. He's no Benny. He's got no big comb over. He's got no fancy car. He doesn't fly around in a private jet. He doesn't have an ostentatious lifestyle. None of those things are wrong with this preacher, but this preacher just preaches something other than Christ and Him crucified. Yeah, occasionally Jesus might get pulled out and paraded around in a special gospel service or maybe at the end of a sermon, but it's not central. That's more dangerous than Benny Hinn. exponentially more dangerous than Benny Hinn. Here's the rest of Dateline NBC.
Christian theologian Michael Horton says it's not just about following the regulations, but about the ministry's message.
Their message is a message of greed. It is a message of selfishness. In very obvious, ribald, clear, crass terms. And they are living accordingly.
And what would Christian watchdog Ole Anthony like to say to Pastor Benny?
Your ministry is based on lies. And it's time to begin telling the truth. Because you're going to have to meet your maker soon.
In the meantime, Benny Hinn and his ministry keep thriving. His TV show is seen 5 days a week on hundreds of stations. His worldwide crusades continue, and the money keeps rolling in. And through it all, Pastor Benny maintains that he has truth and God on his side.
Look at these eyes. I have never lied to you. Never. I never will. I'd rather die than lie to God's people.
We should point out that many other well-known evangelical organizations do voluntarily publish at least some of their financial information, even though that is not required by the IRS. To learn more about that or any of the organizations in our story and to find out how some of your favorite charities are spending...
Okay, that's Stone Phillips following up on the McCowan report on Benny Hinn, Dateline NBC last night. Some final thoughts, and then we're going to spend some time talking about federal legislation that is being introduced tomorrow. This is a breaking story, by the way, to save Terry Schindler Schiavo's life. We'll be talking in just a moment. And then Frank Sherwin will join us in the last part of the program to discuss that story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on those very old 4-million-year-old bones. Final thoughts. What do you do with you're always going to have a Benny Hinn. When he's gone, someone else is going to pop up in his place. These guys are like mushrooms. It's hard to get rid of them. And I don't know if you can. What do you do? Deceive many? Obviously, yes, they do. And he does it while claiming to tell the truth. You and I look at this. Maybe I'm not talking to you. Maybe I'm talking to somebody else. But you and I look at this and we say, it's so obvious. How could anyone be taken in by it? But they are. They are taken in by it. But the greatest tragedy here is that they are being taught a substitute gospel, a substitute Christ, one that does not save. Their faith is being put on, not even being put on Benny. It's being put on things to which Scripture does not direct our faith. Scripture directs our faith in one direction, and that is to Jesus Christ and Him alone and the promises that He makes that are true. And those promises are proven, by the way, by the fact that He was raised from the dead as the all-sufficient sacrifice for sin. And whether it's Benny Hinn or Bill Hybels or Rick Warren or anyone else, when the gospel gets lost in the shuffle, when the message that saves, the power of God unto salvation, gets lost in the shuffle for anything else, healing or purpose or growing your church, then those who suffer are the sinners who need Jesus. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk with Lori Kehoe, spokesperson for National Right to Life, about this new federal legislation.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
One of the most interesting and influential theologians and teachers of the 20th century is also one of the most intriguing preachers of the 20th century. Dr. Norman Nagel is a regular guest on Issues, Etc. And our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is the selected sermons of Norman Nagel. But this book is not about Dr. Nagel. It is, like all of his sermons, about Christ and Him crucified. This selection of over 50 sermons over a lifetime of preaching is $24.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. There you'll find the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, selected sermons of Norman Nagel.
The word all. Now it makes Noah's flood global.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the writers and editors for Creation Magazine.
Well, Ken, I know some say Noah's flood was only a local and not a global event, but are you sure there's proof of a global flood from just one word, as you said?
Well, you know, since none of us were there to see Noah's flood, the only way we can know the truth about this catastrophic event is to have an eyewitness account or record. Now, fortunately, God inspired people to record these events in the Bible, the history book of the universe. And in chapters 6 through 9 of Genesis, there's one word that gives us a clear answer on the extent of the flood. It's the word all, which is kol in Hebrew. And it's used 72 times in chapters 6 through 9 of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 7, verse 19, we read that all the high mountains under all the heavens were covered. In Hebrew, this double use is meant to eliminate any possibility of uncertainty. And the frequency of this word shows that God is really going out of his way to tell us that Noah's flood was a global event. So why don't some people believe all means all? It's because some have listened to the words of fallible men who weren't there, who believe in millions of years and no global flood. It's sad that they, including many church leaders, deny the very clear answers from our infallible Creator who was there.
Read Ken Ham's free booklet on the question, where did Cain find his wife? When you go to your computer screen and log on to AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. According to the American Psychological Association, most people that gamble online tend to have serious gambling addictions. Their study found that 74% of those who gamble on the internet are problematic or pathological gamblers. David Robertson with the National Coalition Against Legalized Gambling says, "Gambling is the fastest growing addiction among youth today. They spend more money on gambling than they do on drugs, and the American public doesn't know that." Remind your teenager that as Christians, we do not need to engage in high-risk behaviors in order to have excitement in our lives. Real excitement comes from being redeemed by Jesus Christ and having His love flow through us to touch the lives of others. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Catch the Vision, an LCMS conference for those interested in prison or jail ministry, will be April 30th through May 1st. Hear how to involve your congregation in prison or jail ministry and how to network with others through LCMS World Relief and Human Care. Choose from workshops on many subjects of specific interest to Lutheran congregations involved in prison and jail ministry. Registration is $50 per person by March 15th. This year, catch the vision of prison and jail ministry. Visit lcms.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the last 25 minutes, two guests. Lori Kehoe joins us very quickly. We're going to be talking with her about federal legislation that's being introduced tomorrow to help save Terry Schindler Schiavo's life. She'll join us here from Washington, D.C. And then Frank Sherwin will be our guest from the Institute for Creation Research. We'll talk about this story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Yesterday's paper, the discovery in Ethiopia of an allegedly 4-million-year-old human ancestor, said in the paper to perhaps be the first walking ancestor. We'll see how that find measures up with Frank Sherwin in a few minutes. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Lori Kehoe is spokesperson for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Lori, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you so much, Todd.
First of all, what's the latest on Terry's condition?
Well, the latest is that so far she's okay. She's been given food and water and will continue to be until March 18th. So we are just praying that the efforts tomorrow in the US Congress and then also in Florida will give her the chance to be able to be fed and have water like the rest of us for the rest of her life.
Tell us about these federal efforts. I hadn't heard about this.
Yes, tomorrow, Congressman Weldon and Senator Martinez, both of them from Florida, but U.S. Senator and U.S. House of Representatives member, will introduce the Incapacitated Persons Legal Protection Act, known in Washington and other places now as Terry's Law. And this will be, it's interesting. What they'll do is be able to apply a writ of habeas corpus to Terry's case. Now, it's questionable if already she would have access to this, but this will make it very clear. And as you know, time is short, so we need to act as quickly as we can. You probably know that habeas corpus is usually used with in capital crimes, and people are convicted of mass murder, such to avoid the danger that an innocent person might be put to death. They're given another level of protection. They're able to go before a federal court to plead their case to make sure that this is not an innocent person being put to death. And frankly, you know, if someone like John Wayne Gacy or Ted Bundy has the right to make sure they're not being killed without due process, certainly an innocent person like Terry Schiavo should be able to at least have this basic level of due process before being starved and dehydrated to death.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that because that's last time we talked about Terry, which was just 10 days ago. I was asking the audience here, look, if a convicted person convicted of a capital crime, if the wheels of justice grind to a halt for them, and rightly so that they might have every opportunity to prove their innocence, exonerate themselves, shouldn't the wheels of justice grind to a halt for Terry Schindler Schiavo? In other words, what's the big hurry?
Yes, that's so true, right? If there's any question, you can always kill her later, you know, but there's nothing you can do about bringing her back to life. So every effort needs to be made here. And I can tell you, this is one of those very unusual circumstances where it's now or never. The judge in Florida has said he's not granting any more stays. Terry is set to begin being starved and dehydrated to death at 1 o'clock on March 18th. The House and the Senate are only in this week and next week before they recess. By the time they get back from recess, she will be dead. So we only have 2 weeks to pass this bill in the House and in the Senate. That's a mind-blowing little amount of time to do this, and yet we are hopeful about it because we think enough members realize the urgency that there is at least a chance. But what the bottom line here is that their phones need to ring off the hook. U.S. Senator phones need to ring off the hook, and your U.S. House House of Representatives member needs to hear from you too. And a person shouldn't think, well, my senator's not pro-life, so forget about him or forget about her. That's not the case here. We're talking about a completely different issue where we have an innocent woman who did not write down that she would want to be starved or dehydrated to death. We have somebody who, her husband, who at first said that he had to take care of her for the rest of her life. Now, we're not judging his motives at all. We're simply saying at first he said, I have to take care of Terry for the rest of her life. You know, for decades she's going to live. I need enough money to take care of her. Then after he got the money, he said, you know, I just remember that Terry said she wanted to be starved and dehydrated to death if she was ever in this condition or something like that. Now, let's just assume that his motives were good in both cases. The fact remains, how can we trust that kind of memory? How can we trust the fact that someone said, okay, she's going to live for decades, and then said she wanted to die, and we're going to sentence a woman to death for that faulty of a memory? That's just absurd. We can't be given that kind of a standard. We can't say, well, you know, what amounts to some third party overheard barroom chatter is going to now qualify somebody for death. If somebody thinks they remembered somebody said this, forget about it. So there's every compelling reason to believe that a senator, whether pro-life or not, and a House member, whether pro-life or not, should be contacted, and people should plead with them to please give Terry a chance.
Well, final question here. First of all, there was a challenge, I believe, to Michael Schiavo's guardianship. How did that turn out? And why doesn't Michael Schiavo just divorce Terry, extricate himself from the entire situation, and go his happy way with his newfound wife and children?
Well, we can't speak to the whole Michael Schiavo issue. I do know one thing that you can read about online too, that Terry's parents through her attorneys have sent him a letter wishing him all the best and their blessings on him and his new family, and that they will never ever sue him. They don't want any money. They don't want any part of the settlement. They released him from any obligation. They just want to take care of their daughter. So I wish that he would do that.
So again, what do our listeners need to do, and do it immediately, to see this federal legislation successfully through?
Yes, please immediately. You can call the switchboard for Congress at 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. Ask to speak with your U.S. senators. You know, you can obviously ask for them one by one, and you'll be connected to their offices, and tell them, please vote yes for Terry's law. We'd also like them, if they would, to co-sponsor the legislation right away. But in any event, to please vote yes on Terry's law. And then you can call the same number and ask to be connected to your House representative, and the same thing, please vote yes on Terry's law. And again, it's Dr. Weldon, who's from Florida, who's carrying it in the U.S. House, and Senator Martinez, who's from Florida, carrying it in the U.S. Senate.
Lori Kehoe is spokesperson for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. their website, nrlc.org, nrlc.org. Lori, thank you for being our guest, and thanks for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Again, the phone number for the switchboard at Congress, area code 202-224-3121. That's area code 202-224-3121. Ask for your senator. One at a time. Say, vote yes on Terry's law. Ask for your congressman. Say, vote yes for Terry's law. Frank Sherwin is our guest to round off today's program. In the last 20 minutes, we're going to discuss a story that may have caught your interest in Sunday's paper, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The headline reads, "Bones may be those of first walking ancestor hominid found in Ethiopia is nearly 4 million years old." We're going to talk about this discovery. Frank Sherwin is a biologist for the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California. Frank, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
What has been found in Ethiopia?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. Again, with these so-called hominid fossils that are allegedly our evolutionary ancestor dating allegedly 4 million years ago, it's very difficult to say with certainty what exactly they found. Of course, as a creation scientist, one who believes the Earth is only thousands of years old and can be scientifically given evidence, compelling evidence for that, we would find shattered remains of fossils like this as simply probably an ape-like creature that may or may not be extinct today.
Okay, now what struck me about this story, and I know very little about archaeology, but I do understand that usually when these finds are made at such antiquity, we're not dealing with full skeletons. Very seldom do we find skulls or jawbones, but we'll usually find a little bit of a arm bone or a leg bone or something along those lines. This one actually has quite a number of the body's bones involved, doesn't it?
That's correct. A complete tibia, which is a part of the leg bone, parts of the thigh bone, which is a femur, ribs, vertebrae, a collarbone, pelvis, complete scapula, which is a shoulder blade. There's also a critical ankle bone, which leads to the idea that perhaps this creature walked upright, although it's been extinct for 4 million years, evolutionarily speaking, so we can safely say today that nobody's actually seen it walk upright. As a matter of fact, Trevor Palmer, who's an atheist, he wrote a book in 1999, and he said that the key advantages gained by early hominids in becoming bipedal are still unclear. And so here we have an evolutionary atheist who's calling into question this whole idea of creatures that walk on all fours all of a sudden deciding for some reason to begin walking upright.
Yeah, that's what I've wondered about. And again, from the layperson's perspective, if I am a bipedal, primarily on-the-ground type of a creature in terms of the evolutionary model, I seem to have a distinct disadvantage over those who can climb trees and get food.
Exactly. Right here in San Diego, where I'm speaking from, we have the famous San Diego Zoo, and we have what's called a living pygmy chimpanzee, and I've actually seen the pygmy chimpanzee there at the San Diego Zoo. About 10% of the time, this creature walks upright. You can tell that it doesn't really like to do that, but the point is it can on occasion. So when they start unearthing these ancient fossils and make the declaration that it supposedly walked upright, I'm sorry, but you know, I'm still skeptical as to whether this should be called a relative of mine or not. As a matter of fact, as recently as 2001, the fossil record offered little information about the origin of bipedalism, that is, walking on two legs, according to an article in Nature magazine by Richmond and Strait, two evolutionary scientists.
There was another fossil that's become famous named Lucy, about, 3.2 million years old.
Correct.
Claims were also made about Lucy, and still are to this day in many a textbook, that she had human-like feet and hands, that she walked upright. Is there any fossil evidence to support those claims about Lucy?
Well, Lucy is a very famous what we call an Australopithecine fossil, and Australopithecus, the word actually means, well, Australo means southern, Pithecus means ape. Well, the word Australopithecus means southern ape. So we as creation scientists here at ICR believe that's exactly what they have been finding. They've been finding dozens of these Australopithecine fossils all of which seem to have characteristics and traits that we would normally and scientifically associate with a creature who is a chimpanzee. The same goes for Lucy. Lucy's hands and fingers were very ape-like, by the way, according to the literature I've been reading. Randall and Sussman wrote in the 1980s about the skeleton of Lucy, showing that although they didn't come right out and say it, it had very ape-like characteristics and traits. And so everything about Lucy was ape-like, ape-like arms and legs and feet and hands, except the skull, which supposedly, according to some evolutionists, seemed to have proto-human type traits. But again, if you go strictly by the evidence, Lucy is not only an ape, an extinct type of ape, but the whole genus of Australopithecus is a mess, according to one evolutionist.
What does that mean? Why is it a mess?
Well, a mess in that because specifically when you start digging up some of these alleged Australopithecine fossils, it's hard to say with the shattered remains of bones and everything else what exactly it is that you're looking at. And so this led to an evolutionist writing in, I think it was GeoTimes magazine. She called, it was a female evolutionist writing in this publication. She said that Australopithecus was a hodgepodge genus. That's quoting her directly. And because it's so difficult to say whether it is a true Australopithecine fossil or not. And so I would think it would be a breath of fresh air to use quotes from leading evolutionists like this lady calling Australopithecus or Lucy a hodgepodge genus. As a taxpayer, I'd really like to see that entered into American public school biology textbooks.
So in other words, here is an evolutionist admitting that perhaps the whole genus of Australopithecus is...
hodgepodge genus.
Well, it is contrived. That is, it doesn't really exist. It's just kind of this catch-all for all these categories of what people think are pre-human ancestors.
Correct. And we should also keep in mind what one evolutionist said, that a single fossil does not a missing link make. And so here they have unearthed, you know, scratched away these layers, and admittedly, of course, they have found a significant portion of the skeleton, but there's no compelling scientific evidence to show that it supposedly sired humans or would sire humans in the future. And so we have to be very, very difficult where science leaves off and nothing more than speculation begins.
It seems to me that the overall search for the bridge between the ape world and human beings, the so-called search for the missing link, violates in a lot of particulars, in particular cases like this, specific cases, Occam's razor. Look, the path of least resistance when it comes to explaining these things, if it looks like an ape, is shaped like an ape, is the size of an ape, it's more reasonable to assume it is an ape rather than a proto-human.
Exactly. I couldn't put any better. Creationists really enjoy Occam's razor simply because it cuts away at a lot of the speculation and simply says, let's look at the evidence, let's make a distinction between what we can clearly see in the evidence and with a limited amount of extrapolation, simply say what it looks like. And so Occam's razor, I think, is the rallying point for creation scientists over and over again.
I remember looking through science textbooks that tried to lay out human ancestry, and all of us are familiar at one time or another of seeing this picture, the progression, the ape at one end walking, a knuckle-walking ape, and then the next person in the parade is a slightly more upright knuckle-walking ape, maybe larger, head maybe a little bit larger, and it progresses all the way to a fully upright walking modern human being. Is this an accurate picture of what fossil evidence has shown us? How much fossil evidence fills in that story?
Well, again, you know, I have to be real careful how I answer that question because it all depends on the artist and the evolutionist and the artist using what I call evolutionary artistic license to, you know, what there are dozens of those kinds of if I can use the word time life book type of progressions that make a very pleasing progression between an ape on the far left-hand side and a fully adult human being on the far right-hand side. So it all depends on what so-called alleged missing links that they use to try and make a pleasing progression. I could take a handful of different kinds of macaroni, throw it out on the table, and make the same kind of progression showing how one kind of macaroni evolved into another. And so, we would have to take that by a case-by-case basis. But I do know that that kind of diagram is becoming out of vogue, and evolutionary naturalists are now appealing to a tree, that it's more of a bush, not even a tree, but a bush of proto-humans allegedly giving rise to the human race today.
Even if there were 4 million years ago in the region we now call Ethiopia, mm-hmm. a tiny ape-like creature that walked 90% of the time bipedally, upright, mm-hmm. would that necessarily lend credence to the whole evolutionary theory about human origins?
Well, I don't think so, because, again, you know, we only have one shattered fossil to go by, and we really cannot say conclusively without a hesitation that it walked upright. I mean, we have to remember what it is that we're looking at, and that is the remains, skeletal remains, fossilized remains of a creature that allegedly it lived 4 million years ago. But let's keep in mind that pygmy chimpanzee that's alive and kicking, no pun intended, today. It is alive. It does occasionally walk upright. So we cannot paint with too broad of a brush and say, if it walks upright, then it's on the way to becoming human. We can't say that because we have apes today that do that.
I'm intrigued by the juxtaposition of two sentences in the AP story that we're using here as the basis of our interview. The first sentence reads, this, a U.S. team of and Ethiopian scientists have discovered fossilized remains of what they believe is humankind's first walking ancestor. Two paragraphs down, this sentence is found. The bones are the latest in a growing collection of early human fragments that help explain the evolutionary history of man. There seems to have been a leap here in the story so far.
And, you know, and we see that over and over again. And I would really ask folks who are listening in the radio, both Christian and non-Christian, to be very, very skeptical, very cautious about what you're reading when they start making grand extrapolations, such as what we read in this article. It's one thing to say you found some shattered remains of bones in an area, but it's quite another to start giving these great ages to these bones and start saying what this creature did allegedly 4 million years ago. I mean, there's an incredible leap there. I mean, we have to make a distinction between where science ends and evolutionary speculation begins. I should also add that it says in this article, the findings have not been reviewed by outside scientists or published in the scientific journal, end quote. So that speaks volumes.
So the whole peer review process has yet to be undertaken for these particular fossils.
That's exactly it. I mean, the article does go on to talk about Ramidus, and I won't get into too much about Australopithecus Ramidus, except to say that there's a lot of dissension within the paleoanthropological circles about Ramidus and what position it was and what this creature was and so forth. An atheist by the name of Peter Andrews, who's an anthropologist, he disagrees with fellow evolutionists regarding their interpretation of Ramidus, and he has some real good scientific reasons why.
How would the discoverers of these fossils determine an age of 4 million years?
Well, basically, what they do is they look at the levels, the strata of where they find the fossils and decide that this strata is this old because we find these kinds of fossils in the strata. Well, how old do you know those fossils are? Well, it's because it was found in this strata. How old do you know the strata? It's because we find these fossils. It's a tautology. It's a circuitous type of situation there.
Isn't that kind of like saying I go through a house and after it's burned down, and I find the car keys in a particular room, and so I simply assume that room was the garage,
right,
even though it may have been the bedroom?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good analogy. I've never heard it put that way, but that's a good way to put it. Now, sometimes evolutionists would counter what I just described by saying there's, I don't want to get too technical here this evening, but they call it an igneous intrusion. That is, some igneous rock that contains some radioactive material might be extruded up into the sedimentary layers where you find these fossils, and therefore they can kind of give an age to those fossil remains due to this igneous intrusion of radioactive material. But even then, that's problematic because we get into the problem what's called radiometric dating, which, by the way, I hasten to add, has nothing to do with carbon-14 dating, which is very, very different. But if somebody has some questions regarding age of the Earth, I would direct them to www.icr.org, where we're just finishing up the RATE project, R-A-T-E, where ICR scientists, about 8 PhD scientists, have addressed this whole issue of the age of the Earth.
It's an excellent place to go, by the way. I was very recently there looking into the RATE project because I had some questions from listeners about the whole dating issue in the age of the Earth as well. Frank Sherwin is a biologist for the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California. Frank, thank you very much for being our guest.
I appreciate it very much, and please call anytime.
He mentioned their website. I'll mention it again, icr.org. It's the website for the Institute for Creation Research, icr.org. And in particular, that RATE project should be of special interest to you. This is one of those places where Christians and creationists are often stumped. Well, we've got this carbon-14 dating. We've got all these dating methods. How in the world can you refute that? Well, go and see icr.org, icr.org. There is a two-week residential program on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. In a church where, well, a find like this might shake the faith of a pastor or two, or might give him evidence when he walks into his Bible class to say, there you see it, folks. I told you that the story of creation as given to us in Genesis is a myth. We're supposed to learn moral lessons and philosophical and theological lessons from it, but it's not true. They might find it a story like this as evidence. They might even present it as evidence to their Bible class to refute the biblical story of the creation. No such teaching at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. The Bible is taken seriously, even when it teaches something as seemingly anachronistic as a six-day creation. It's taken seriously as God's word from beginning to end. Now, if you know a high school-aged man in your congregation, in your family, who would benefit from getting a taste of what it's like to study to be a pastor, sitting in the classroom, in the chapel, with the faculty, with the students, getting the entire seminary life experience, already there in high school for 2 weeks during the summer, I invite you to check out Christ Academy 2005. You can find out more about it by going to our website, issuesetc.org. There at our website, right on the homepage, if you simply scroll down a little bit, you will find the Christ Academy 2005 logo, and next to it, a link to more information about this two-week residential program for high school-aged men who are interested in looking into the prospect of studying for the pastoral ministry. You can also go to the website for Concordia Theological Seminary, www.ctsfw.edu, or call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155. That's 1-800-481-2155. Again, our website address for more information on Christ Academy 2005, issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be looking into a sermon from Pastor Will Wheaton. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues at 7.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.